Aujourd'hui, je vais parler tout seul parce que Monsieur Grenet est un peu enrhumé et mal de gorge, donc je parle seul. Excusez-nous. Donc, je parle en anglais. And let's start. Last time we finished our introduction to an important document on the invoice of Kangju and Suxian from the Xuanquan ruins in the northwest of China. And this document is dated in 39 BCE, but very likely the Han court had known about Kangju almost 100 years ago. Concerning the years 134 BCE and 130 BCE, here I follow the revised edition of Yu Taishan's Sai Zhongshi Congkao, a study of Saka history, published in Peking in 2012. It was updated from the first edition in 1992, which was then translated into English and published in America. Recently, my Peking colleagues informed me that actually the English version of the revised Chinese version was also published just at the end of last year. But unfortunately, due to the COVID situation and the disturbed business of China Post, I have not received this book. Anyway, as I will try to explain, Yu's work can be said as the best and most comprehensible ones right now among Chinese publications concerning the history of Kangju and its neighbors. And personally, I appreciate his effort much because he insists to publish his important works in traditional Chinese characters without creating his own translation or transposition for some names difficult to Chinese. And I say so because I am expected more and more often to translate ancient Kuchian or Gandharin names into Mandarin by spelling it in a modern way when writing a paper right now for Chinese readers. Nevertheless, one has to be careful when reading and using Yu Taishan's work. In one phrase, with regarding to some important historical issues, his works almost like a modern patchwork like Tongdian. So, before one uses it, it is often necessary to trace the origin of his statements and the underlying reason of his judgment. So I will do it side by side with an introduction to the historical background until the establishment of the protectorate of Western regions or Xiyu in the Tarim Basin. In brief, in addition to a firm sinological training in Beijing, Yu Taishan is largely based on his understanding of early scholars, especially Japanese and German, such as Shiratori in Tokyo and Kuwabara in Kyoto and Marquardt in Berlin. However, old German works are too complicated, of course, even to me and to many modern Westerners. So I think it's safe to say that Yu's understanding of German works is largely based on Shiratori's and Kuwabara's digest of Iran Shah and other works by Marquardt, etc., in their Japanese works. For instance, so far we have talked about the five petty kings subject to Kangju for several times. And on these issues, Yu's opinion is against Shiratori because he chose to believe Xin Tang Shu in one phrase. But such a situation happens quite rarely, since Shiratori's writing can be said as the skeleton of Yu's point of view on many key topics. So, if the early pioneers such as Xu Song in Qing Dynasty of China can be called as the stage zero concerning the development of history of Kangju and other peoples, then Shiratori can be no doubt perceived as the most important scholar at its stage one in the early 20th century. Personally, I like to say that I like to read Shiratori's paper and books very much, but I don't like his family and his background. He and some member of his family were very knowledgeable in German to the extent that one of them even became a diplomat and involved with the ally among Germany, Italy, and Japan in World War II. However, I think our seminar here is a purely academic view, concerning ancient history rather than contemporary history. So I will only explain the academical issues. First of all, it is noteworthy that in Shiratori's view, the Chinese name in ancient Fergana should pronounce in Mandarin as Da Wan rather than Da Yuan. At last time, I mentioned that Bichurin gives it as Da Wan as well. So, the English title of Shiratori 1916 is most probably a typo or a compromise with some Western scholarship in his days. In fact, what I was told since my childhood is also Da Wan, and like Rouzhi rather than the Yuezhi, etc. So I usually felt unaccustomed to some Western translations because of this or that etymological ground. And I don't think Shiratori created the pronunciation by his own, because he and as many Japanese scholars in his days stayed in China for a long period. Some of his colleagues and his kamahat stayed in China for a long period before becoming professor in Japan. So, among these papers, and these are only a small part of Shiratori's publications, the one being most influential to Sogdian study is no doubt 1924, the Sokutokoku, very difficult to pronounce it in Japanese. And it was translated into English 4 years later. In this paper, he rejects huge identification of Su Yi with Sogdak around the Black Sea, but with Sogdiana, together with many other useful points and inspiring ideas. But this paper also shows a tendency in his later work, that is to say, to identify ancient peoples in northwestern China and in Central Asia as proto-Turkic as much as possible. This more or less reflects the Pan-Ataikism or Pan-Tongusism in Japan during its expansion to Russia and China in order to find a cultural root of ancient Japanese back to Eurasia. So it is parallel to the phenomena in his days that many Western scholars try to find Indo-European or more exactly Indo-Germanish elements in Central Asia during the Big Game. So in that epic era, I would say Pilio and Shiratori are the founders of Sogdian studies in the West and East respectively, because Pilio did a lot with his students on the decipherment of Sogdian languages, as well as the existence of Sogdian settlement in medieval China. On the other hand, Shiratori re-established the history of Sogdiana from Chinese sources. They achieved the same conclusion from time to time, so I think most probably independently during the wartime. For example, last year and also last session, I think, we indicated Pelio's paper about ancient Chinese transcription of Huan Qian in 1938 and in the Journal of Tongbao. But Shiratori had indicated the possibility 10 years before. So he wrote, it was probably even known in the Han period too that for the Da Wan Zhuan or biography of Da Yuan or Da Wan of the Shi Ji mentioned Huan Qian, which we may assume to be a contracted transcription of Huarism. No less were Huan Huo Xun and Huo Li in the Tang period. So, in one phrase, Shiratori's sense of Chinese classics is extraordinarily excellent. But when he tried to use Western etymological methods to solve some non-Chinese terms, he is not usually correct and has some bias, like most scholars in that period of imperialism and colonialism. So I think it is convincing that Kangju is to be distinguished from Sogdiana, as argued in the chapter 1 of his long paper, but he concluded by conjecturing their difference as linguistical and ethnic ones, so that Kangju is Altaic or even Turkic, while Sogdiana is an Iranian land. This view is obviously to be justified by philological and archaeological data nowadays. And I think Yu Taishan has always tried to avoid this kind of bias. He seldom used Altaic or Indo-European skills or reference in his work, but directly refers himself back to Greek or Latin such as Herodotus. But in mainland China, just after the Cultural Revolution, what could be provided in the university education was very poor. So Yu and his contemporary had no choice but to try to do their best to link Chinese and Western classics all together, usually in an intuitive manner. So I won't blame such a shortcomings, and it is not the fault of any individuals, but a common burden of his younger days. Now let's read Yu Taishan's representative works closer and in a more strict way. So, 康居在大阪, 康居在大阪西北可二千里, 行国, and Yu, sorry, I cannot read this English text very well, I just read. Kangju is at a distance about 2,000 li northwest of Dayuan. It is a land of nomad and followed very much the same way of life at the Yuezhi. They have 80 or 90,000 trained bowmen. The state is conterminous with Dayuan and is small. In the south, the inhabitants were constrained to serve the Yuezhi in the east, and in the east to serve the Xiongnu. A few years ago, when I compiled the Chinese sources about Kidarite and Heptalite for a group of scholars in the British Museum, Emer Galambos reminded me that one should always add the before the name if it is to be perceived as a people, no matter it means a nomadic people or not. On the other hand, if the name, for example, Kangju, refers to a state, a region, a piece of land, etc., then it is not necessary to give the. So, first of all, we can ask ourselves if the is to be put here as the Kangju or not. And even if this question purely concerning English grammar is not so essential, a crucial problem immediately arrives, namely, how to translate 可二千里, here highlighted in blue, with at a distance of about 2,000 li. On this expression, Yu chooses a translation quite different from earlier ones. For example, Shiratori gives situated about 2,000 li, and this is the one adopted by Eric Thurre in his paper for the a conference on the dating of Kanishka, a very famous paper. And then for Watson's translation of Shiji, English translation, he translated it as situated some 2,000 li, and François Thierry translated as situé à environ 2,000 li, and as we have mentioned briefly before, 1 li in the Han period is about 400 meters, and at any rate less than 500 meters. So, for some of you being not so familiar with classical Chinese here in this room, it could be helpful if I just translate straightforwardly and literally as can be said as far as 2,000 li. And this is a very vague expression. For you, I collect four examples in the same work. The first, here, 左贤王为李将军，足可四千人. It means the Zuoxian Wang, or literally wise king to the left of the Xiongnu people in the north of China, besieged the general Li, Li Guang. His soldier could be said as many as 4,000. And the second example is 夺旗军可四千余人, and I translate it tentatively as the founder of Han Dynasty took over the troop of his enemy, and they could be said as many as more than 4,000. So here more than corresponded with this character Yu, more than or over. And the third example, 项羽之卒可十万. So the soldiers led by 项羽, namely the most important rival of the founder of the Han Dynasty, could be said as many as 100,000. So in the first example, it is also a vague expression, and I would say that the actual number could be very close to 4,000, let's say 3,800 or 3,900, but to say 4,200 could be too much. And for the second example, it is almost for sure that the actual number is more than the round number of 4,000. But for the third example, this could be rather exaggerating in order to emphasize the greatness of the founder of the Han Dynasty. And the actual number could be only, for example, 80 or 90,000 or even less. Okay. And I have the fourth example for you. It is a passage from the same work concerning the astronomical fact or records in the same book. And in this phrase, it says comet or shooting star in this year, its length can be said as long as 4 dang, and after a while, its length can be said as long as 5 or 6 dang. In this phrase, 长可五六丈, or its length can be said as long as 5 or 6 dang, could mean that the length is variable and not determined. So, in brief, here I would rather translate this 可 in French as environ or presque or à peu près, so according to the context of every passage, each passage. In this way, let's take a glimpse on Zhang Qian's first mission from the Shi Ji, who arrived Bactria around 129 BCE. In fact, from a healthy discussion in Japan since Shiratori and his contemporaries, it is widely accepted that the whole passage I just read for you is most probably from Zhang Qian's original report to the Han court. And these pioneers are, I already said, Shiratori, and Kuwabara, and Fujita. All of them were originally educated in the Japanese Imperial University of Tokyo, but Shiratori went to Europe several times, so he is more famous in the West, and the other two went to mainland China and had close relations with traditional Chinese scholars. It is Kuwabara who gives the safe dating of Zhang Qian's departure from China and return, and the date return back to China in a lecture date in 1910. On the other hand, Fujita was once dispatched to Taipei in order to operate the School of Humanities and Social Sciences of the Japanese Imperial Taipei University there, but he became ill soon and died in the next year. So, based on Zhang Qian's report analyzable from the Shi Ji, the relative distance and orientations among the remote countries can be shown in these brief diagrams. For the state of Dayuan or Dawan, or Fergana that we usually said, its political center is at any rate around today's Fergana Valley. And there are four states or peoples nearby it, namely the Wusun and Kangju, the Da Yuezhi or Great Yuezhi, and Daxia. And Daxia is situated at Bactria, or let's say around today's northern Afghanistan, while Anxi or Arsak, namely Partia, and Yancai here, most likely Aozi, were situated very remotely. So anyone who wants to discuss the location of Kangju in Zhang Qian's report must discuss Dayuan or Dawan at the same time. And concerning their distance, actually, in 1915 to 1916, a hot debate arises between these three, and I would say that this resulted in the split of Kyoto School from Tokyo School for nearly one century. It is in 1916 that Bai published the Daien Kokuko, this paper, or study of Dawan, I already said, that Shiratori changed his view on the location of Dawan's capital city, the Guishan city, from Kozan to Kasan. On the other hand, Kuwabara thought Kozan is still a good candidate and published a paper, Taien Kok no Kizanjo Nizide, this one, just a little bit before for it, and the paper of his lecture was formally published next year. And I would tentatively translate his title as On the Guishan City of the State of Dawan. And the other is Zhang Qian's Mission. So then Fujita immediately published a paper, and I just tentatively give the English title as The Guishan City of the State of Dawan and the Ordu of the Yuezhi. And in this paper, Fujita strongly defended Shiratori's new idea. Okay. In other words, in this period, these three scholars do not only paid attention to Zhang Qian's missions, but also to Han China's conquest to Ferghana, as stated in the Shiji and Han Shu. However, it is not easy to find a good map that encloses all the toponyms in their discussions. But one can at least find both Kozan and Kasan on this map. By Marquardt in 1938, Weholt und Anhang. So this is this book, Le Weholt und Anhang, very famous. And it is a research on the myths and history of the local peoples around the East Iran. Okay, so the difference of the Kyoto and Tokyo schools can be demonstrated as follows. Here it is what Shiratori would like to identify as Guishan City near Kasan, a small town near Nabagans. And on the other hand, this is the Kuwabara's theory, who still think Kozan is a good candidate, although he did not determine any final solutions. And on these series divergence, Yu aligned himself with Kuwabara. Unfortunately, there is no map at all in Yu Taishan's works, and this is a great pity, and it has caused so much inconvenience to his reader. In other words, Yu's scope is to be traced back to the old map in his younger days, and it is based on those maps that Yu Taishan tried to make a compromise between the two Japanese views. So, in Yu Taishan's Saizhong Shi Congkao, or A Study of Sakha History, it says, in the Han Shu chapter 96, on the biography of Western regions, it is recorded, the seat of the royal government of Dayuan is at the town of Guishan. It is 1,510 li north to the town of Beitian in Kangju. Since Guishan was situated at Kozan, actually, he refers to chapter 4 of his own book, and namely Kuwabara's theory in 1910s. The town of Beitian must have been situated to the south of the Karatau and north of the Sirdaria, around Turkestan. So, for this footnote, actually, he refers to Shiratori and another Shiratori. These are a republished edition of the earlier papers that I already presented. Okay. Last time, I think we have demonstrated that, actually Fons has demonstrated that nowadays archaeologists are talking about the main campus or main area of Kangju people's activities around the south of Karatau cities here. And by using the map of Podushkin, and this result is actually very close already to Shiratori's conjectures. Now, let's read Yu's commentary on the entry on Kangju in the Shiji again. Just on the note 15.8, about 2,000 li and distance 4. The approximate distance between the seat of the king's government of Dayuan and that of Kangju. This is what means about 2,000 li. And it means roughly the distance from Fergana to Turkestan, north of the Sirdarya. Actually, as a philologist and historian, I was not educated in mainland China but in Paris, so I don't think I'm qualified enough to explain Yu Taishan's theory on his behalf. But as far as I can see, concerning geographical distance measured in li, Yu Taishan affirmed the theories of Matsuda and Nagasawa of the Waseda University in Tokyo. Such an opinion is expressed in a footnote in one of his bestsellers, saying concerning the li measurement and itinerary network of the Silk Work in the Han Dynasty, all the works are unreliable, except for the ones written by Matsuda. This one, the English title is The Geohistorical Studies on the Ancient Tianshan Region. It is a book first published in 1956 and then revised in 70. And the second author Yu Taishan trusts very much is Nagasawa. A specialist paper and only the title is on the description of the distance as revealed in the biographies of Xi Yu Zhuan, Xi Yu, or in Chinese Xi Yu Zhuan, of the history of the former Han Dynasty. So, in Yu's view, all other works are only occasionally correct by chance and to be treated case by case. Now, you know that Yu's calculation of li distance is based on Matsuda and Nagasawa, and Yu Taishan further improved their theory a bit. In fact, as I said, they are from the same university, a very prestigious but private one in Tokyo. And the scholars being able to get tenure in University of Tokyo are also active, including Enoki, a great scholar in the studies on the Kidarite and Ephthalite, and his disciples Morris and others. On the other hand, Kyoto University also trained many scholars, including Uchida Ginpu, who contribute a lot on the reconstruction of the Wei Shu, and Odani Nakao. He wrote on the Great Yue Zhi a lot. There are, of course, also many other Japanese scholars in the same field, but today I only enumerate those frequently mentioned in Yu Taishan's works because their main research interests until 1990s overlapped each other, while the names in blue focus more on the 7th century and later. Unfortunately, perhaps due to reading ability or to an atmosphere after the World War II, Japanese works are generally undervalued in the West. For example, in the most representative English translation of biography of Zhang Qian, the General Li Guangli who conquered Fergana, and the general statement about Western countries in the Hanshu, so this book, China in Central Asia, the early stage, yes, we already referred to this translation during our seminar many times. This book obviously oversimplified and in some cases even misunderstood the achievement by Japanese scholarship. For instance, the influential introduction to this book saying, in the notes, we refer to several geographical atlases, but the reader will hardly find a reference to the Japanese historical atlas for Asia by Matsuda and Mori, Ajialeksi Chizu, because the relevant maps are practically identical with those in Albert Hellman's useful works, being moreover drawn on so reduced a scale as to render them useless for question of detail. Well, even though Halsey mentions Matsuda in a few footnotes of this book, it seems he only understood Japanese work to a limited extent. But it is exactly in the same year, in 1979, that Nagasawa proposed the whole diagram. The whole diagram of the Li itinerary based on the data preserved in the Hanshu, or Book of the Han. Here I color it and give some basic toponyms for your convenience. In this diagram, the northern part had been treated in Matsuda's book in 1956. So, in this respect, Yu's commentary is far more advanced than Hulsevi's, even though he almost fully adopted his English translation of the Hanshu in his book. Of course, I'm not saying that Japanese or Chinese must be correct, but if one just keeps neglecting the sinological discussion in East Asia, it will be very risky. After all, the scholars inherit traditional knowledge of the imperial China, such as Wang Xianqian or Xu Song, and many other earlier Chinese scholars. Anyway, let's see what means Albert Hellman's useful work mentioned by Louis. It means Hellman's dissertation in 1910. So it is this book. Die Alten Seidenstraßen zwischen China and Zihin, or the Silk Work between China and Syria. Actually, it cost me much time in Japan to find a good scanner for scanning his map, as well as other German maps here, as there are different but all very used copies in Kyoto University and other universities, including the ones donated by Kuwabara Takeo from his father's collections. So here, this is the map of Hellman, as an appendix or additional map at the end of his dissertation. And this is the one provided by Marquardt in 1938. So actually, Kuwabara Takeo is a famous scholar in Japan. He translated Le Rouge et Noir and Le Contrat Social and many other French literature into Japanese. And he also inherited his father's research interest in China and in Inner Asia, so he led the publication of Kyoto University's research report on the Yungang grottoes and other fieldwork area in China. And he also helped to establish his university's geographical and archaeological expedition to Afghanistan and Pakistan during his career as the director of Institute of Research in Humanities. Kyoto University. Oh, no, he's not the one who really traveled there. He only went to Bhutan and other, but he's very good in European languages, you know. Now, let's return to Yu's commentary and Hellman's map. I just show this slide again. So, again on this note that the approximate distance between the seat of the king's government of Dayuan and that of Kangju, roughly the distance from Fergana to the Turkestan north of the Sirdarya. So about this Turkestan north of Sirdarya, it is not clear that in this phrase itself whether it means a small town or a large area. If we look Hellman's map here, it is just the name of the town. I try to enlarge this, right? This is Turkestan here, right? Okay. And yeah, while if we look Marquardt's map, it is indeed means also a town to the north of Sirdarya and south of the Karatau here, Karatau Mountains. Therefore, Yu's commentary implies that the capital of Kangju in Zhang Qian's period is most likely around Turkestan. On the other hand, Shiratori once expressed his concept of the capital city of Kangju, Beitiancheng, in the Han Shu. Well, this name is actually not found in the Shi Ji, but only in the Han Shu Book of the Han, so written a little bit later. So, Shiratori assumed that it was Beitiancheng, it was an ancient city situated in the area from Chimkent here, and to the area around Turkestan here, because this area is good for water, grassland, and relatively free from the northern wind. And I have to say that Shiratori never traveled into Central Asia. He just somehow make this conjecture.
And my voice seems to be back, so I just want to comment shortly. This is an extraordinary intuition.
Yes, because, intuition, indeed.
Because it matches exactly
yes.
the current opinion of archaeologists, especially Potushkin, about the probable location of the zone of Beitian.
Yes.
Actually, Turkestan is still a famous site, but it's famous mainly because of its shrine to Roger Ahmad Yassawi, erected by Tamerlane. So it's a major touristic site. And it is the northern, well, I would say, the northern site where there are clusters of Kangju graves, and also there is a settlement, not very big, but there is a settlement which I intend to present in the last sessions, and also concentrating on including the Aris region is an excellent intuition. I might add another argument, which is actually mentioned by Yatsenko. It is stated, I think it is in the Hanshu, that the Beitian is close to a big lake.
Mm-hmm.
And well, if you look at the map, the American air map, you find a big lake not far from near towards the lower Aris River,
mm-hmm.
and as Yatsenko says. Well, other lakes might have existed in the past, simply the course of the Sir Daria and Aris is very meandering. So there are plenty of possibilities that other big lakes might have existed. Something I don't understand, you quoted before.
Yes.
From Mutai Shan quoting Kuwa Barra, it's apparently sentence in the Hanshu is that Kushan, capital of Taiwan, is north of Beitian.
Beitian is north. Huh? Beitian is northwest north. To the
okay.
Guishan.
It's not really, it's not completely true. For us it's northwest, rather than north. Okay, in this sense, it's accepted. Then, but maybe at the end of this session, I would like to make a short comment on the simultaneous apparition, simultaneous beginning of a real scientific history of Sogdiana, both in the West,
yes.
by Pelio,
yes.
he is the founder of
yes,
the
I think so.
Sogdology in the 1930s in his articles, and by Shiratori,
mm-hmm.
who is unquestionably the founder of Japanese Sogdology. At the same time, shortly afterwards, 1947, I would like to mention the articles which set up the real beginning of Soviet Sovietology from archaeological materials. And I must add that at that time, the Soviets probably were not acquainted with Shiratori, and possibly were not acquainted with Pelio either.
Possibly.
But it's interesting to see that Sogdology crystallized in the 30s and 40s. It crystallized in the mind of scholars, and before it really exploded in the 50s and 60s with the excavation of Benjiket.
Okay.
But I make a short intervention.
Yes, of course. So, we just talk about that. Yes, in this phrase, it is not so clear that whether here Turkestan means a region or a town or not. And at least as
I
far...
I think it means a town.
But yes, as I will show, try to show. As far as we can see from on the Hermann's map and Marquardt one, well, indeed, Turkestan just means a town. And... the problem is that concerning the Tianchi, you just mentioned the same character as Beitiancheng, because Beitian literally it can be perhaps translated as lower than Tian. So if this Tian indeed mean Tianchi, then usually sinologists would interpret that Tianchi as Isikul, but Isikul is here. And here is what Hermann put his country here, and then also his Dayuan here around Fergana. But I think we can go back to the problem of Tianchi for the next session, next Thursday. Now, let's just go through this one. And if we look another German work and his map, Franke's Beiträge aus chinesischen Quellen zur Kenntnis der Türkvölker und Skitten Zentrasien. So, research from Chinese sources on the knowledge about Turkic people and of Central Asia. So, the map in his book in Franke, 1904, is based on Sven Hedin's travel into Central Asia and Northwestern China around the turn of the 20th century. And, well, this copy also belongs to Kuwabala's personal collection. Okay. Franke's map, based on Sven Hedin, Turkestan is clearly drawn as a region. I already put here for you, and which represents the European idea in many other maps in the 19th century. So, it is outside the Qing Empire of China in Sven Hedin's days, and which built the Xinjiang province between the Altai Mountains and the Pamirs in around 1884, I think. So, on this French map, I forgot to add it, but well, I will show it next time. There's another French map drawn in the 19th century that also expressed the concept of Turkestan as a region as an example. Actually, it just means something between the Oxus and the Yarhat. Do you have any?
The notion of Turkestan is floating, really floating.
Yes, I think so.
As you said, in some context, it is the town of Turkestan. In some context, it's a region where all which can be seen is that, say, is a country of the Turks north of the country of the Iranian speaking Sogdians. And then, where? We have an element now, but unfortunately it does not provide a geographical location. As far as I know, and I think Etienne will agree, the very first apparition of the term Turkestan in written sources is the slave selling contract from Turfan, dated 639, edited by Yutaka Yoshida.
Mm-hmm.
And it is when a slave girl is sold on the market in Turfan. The buyer is Chinese,
mm-hmm.
supposed to be a monk. The seller and witnesses, I think, are all Sogdian. And the girl is said to be from Turkestan, slave girl from Turkestan, and her name, if I remember, or rather nickname, is I think Turk, but I don't remember exactly. Opacha, which means then we had
auntie or something.
She did not
yes.
know that, but it means. As we say now in French for a little girl, we say petite mère.
Mm-hmm.
It's auntie, it's an affectionate term for a girl. Well, she's from Turkestan.
But
nothing else is.
Actually, I gave a note already, although not yet published, but well. I think 2 years ago, Adam Benketo wrote me about how to identify etymology of this girl's name, and I also answered as fast as I can. But in the meantime, I also remind him, and perhaps he had incorporated this note somewhere in his latest work. And I think this girl, she is known to be from the Chuyak, right? The Chuyak tribe? And
yes.
I think Chuyak is just the Zhuye clan of the Shatuo people. It is a people around the northwest China, actually not far at all. I mean, it is here around inside today's China, just between Xinjiang and even Gansu, and just very active around Turfan. So it is not necessary to identify Turkestan in that country. Contract
in that
era.
Context,
yes.
Turkestan could be a covering name for a country of nomadic
yes.
Turks.
Yes, actually.
It can stretch from the borders of China
yes.
to. It's just to differentiate from,
yes.
from Chinese, from
yes.
people in the Daring principalities, and from the Soviets.
Yes. So my concern is what means, I mean, in Shilato these days, what means Turkestan and when he studied abroad in Europe and learned about the concept of Turkestan and then used this of concept in his theory of ancient peoples. Otherwise,
in medieval sources, what Turkestan as a designation of territories south of Sirdarya down to the Amudarya
mm-hmm.
Was due to the Russians. And it was simply a way to give a name, a sort of a cover name for the territories they had conquested, taking into account the fact that most people were Turkish speaking. But I don't think in medieval sources we find Turkestan applied to the zone between Amudarya and Sirdarya,
mm-hmm.
which is usually called Navarana, which means the country between the rivers.
On a effectivement s'apporté dans le contrat sogdien entre Turfan et Hamoutoum Turkestan, c'est effectivement intéressant si vous pouvez lui les lier aux châteaux qui sont juste au nord de Turfan, hein, juste au nord du bord de la chaîne.
Ça c'est nouveau.
Donc ça c'est bien. Mais en fait, on a un autre texte qui est extrêmement intéressant, c'est le texte édité par Thibault et Nicolas, si vous vous souvenez. Nicolas et Léna, toujours, si vous souvenez, dans lequel une lettre sogdienne envoyée à Turfan dans lequel en fait l'employé du grand marchand saoudien explique qu'il aurait pu envoyer les biens de ce grand marchand dans un certain nombre d'endroits, mais il aurait pu aller, je ne suis pas allé en Sogd, je ne suis pas allé au Turkestan ni au Tibet. Donc on a le Turkestan, on a visiblement il y a la Sogdiane, comprise comme je pense la partie sédentaire iranophone, opposée au pays des Turcs et au Tibet, mais surtout après, il dit aussi à propos de ses biens, la plupart de ses biens sont sortis de mes mains, les uns à Rundan, c'est-à-dire en Chine, la capitale chinoise, chez les Ouïghours. Donc on est à Fred 744, au moment où les Ouïghours contrôlent donc la Mongolie, et au Turkestan. Donc la Mongolie n'est pas le Turkestan. C'est ça qui est intéressant. Donc à mon avis, le Turkestan, ça colle très bien ce que vous avez dit sur les châteaux. Le Turkestan, pour moi, c'est le flanc nord de Tien Shan. Du Semerhetier, du Sir Daria, si vous voulez, le Turkestan, la ville de Turkestan actuelle, jusqu'au nord de Ami, au nord de Turfan, etc. C'est vraiment la zone nomade, l'endroit où commence la zone nomade, le nord de Tien Shan.
Mais donc, est-ce nomade, oui.
Parce qu'on a une série
de. Les Ouïghours, ils ne sont pas encore.
Voilà, ils sont en train de. Voilà, mais le centre de leur pays, c'est le nord. Et voilà, le pays des Turcs est encore désigné comme opposé au pays des Ouïghours, qui là ne peut être que la Mongolie.
Okay, actually, I just continue to show more maps and old and contemporary ones. So, but I forgot to put this old French map. Anyway, so again, I just show this area map that I took during my flight from Kyoto to from Osaka to Paris this year. And actually, if we read Shiratori's papers very closely, and it is almost the same as Yu Taishan's expression on the boundary of Kangju, namely it should be north of the Sir Daria and just, well, this southern area, I'm not so sure, but at any rate, the eastmost border is around Taraz. And a very similar concept, but not so totally identical, can be found on the map of the Western Han China from the 中国历史地图集, namely the official historical maps of the ancient China published in Peking in 2080. So this is the map, and here we have the capital of Western Han, and by enlarging it here you see Kangju. So a little bit intrude to the south of the Sir Daria, actually, because sinologists in China believe that in that period Sogdiana was subjected to Kangju. So in this sense, Sogdiana is also included in this general term. On the other hand, when the period was turned to the Eastern Han China, now the official map of the PRC China just distinguish Suyi here, or Sogdiana, to the south of Sir Daria, from Kangju to the north of Sir Daria. So is that okay for you? And well, of course you can ask whether it is good or not to put Fergana or Dayuan into Han's own territory, but this is not my issue today, just to show you how people today in China consider about the territory of Kangju on the westernmost area to the outside China. Actually, in a map that we already showed last year from Yoshida's book, together with another Japanese scholars, on the Sogdian art and Sogdian languages, published in 2011, he provide a map of the Kushan dynasty, so, well, a little bit contemporary with the Eastern Han period and later, around the 1st century to 3 or 4th, well, as depending on how do you define what is Kushan dynasty. So, in that time, we already provide a very simple English translation for the most important peoples to the north and west of China. So you see here is the Xiongnu, the most powerful nomad in the north of China, Han China, and also the Usun to the north of the Tianshan Mountains here, and Dayuan or Dawan, the Fergana Valley, Kangju just to the south of the Aurasi, right? And between the Yarhat and Oxus. And the most remote one is Yancai or Arzi. But if you look it closer, actually in this map, the boundary between Kangju and Yancai is not drawn at all. On the other hand, in this period, Yoshida would distinguish Sogdiana here from Kangju. So Sogdiana in the Kushan period is to be enclosed within Kushan dynasty, while Kangju just occupied a more northern area between the two rivers, just to the Aral Sea, perhaps, and then also perhaps broader, but actually he did not. I will explain.
On this just one point. But the, I wouldn't say wrong, but his information probably at that time was not completely up to date. Because now we have more very solid reasons to put the border between Sogdiana and Kangju along the Baishu and Hisa.
Branch.
We have both numismatic reasons and archaeological reasons.
Yeah, then we can discuss that next time.
Exploration of the zone and more precise numismatic studies. But this is a general tendency. This has been a general tendency since the beginning of the Kushan studies to put the Kushan border too far. For many years after Tolstoy, the Soviets have put the Kushan boundary up to Khwarezm, and then there is a persisting, a lingering tendency to draw, to include Samarkand in the Kushan Empire. After excavating 20 years at Samarkand, I am absolutely convinced that it was never part of the Kushan Empire. Maybe there were some inroads, maybe some episodes.
Okay.
But it was not structurally part of the Kushan Empire.
Well,
this is another point we can discuss.
Yes, of course. Here I just want to show that actually this map is not drawn by Yoshida his own, I think. He's from another earlier map by Odani, so I just choose this for you. Although I plan to explain it later. It's not this one. Okay, you see this one? So here you see this is Bactria. And yes, actually it is from Odani's book. Almost identical, so namely from Odani's book in 2010 and on the Great Yuezhi, and the first edition is 1999. So just to show you the model in Odani's opinion, actually he's also from Kyoto as Yoshida sensei. So in Odani's view, around the 3rd century BCE, Yuezhi is somehow roughly spread in the northwest of China and quite remotely, and then somehow after several attacks by the Xiongnu around the 2nd century BCE, it was split to the Great Yuezhi and the smaller Yuezhi, and brief, it seems that the main branch of the Yuezhi or the Great Yuezhi just somehow moved, somehow I mean that the itinerary is not clear at all, but somehow moved westward just to today's Bactra or Tokharistan. So, and here I just draw the boundary of Partia for you. So this pink, it means Partia at that, both in the same map, and this is the boundary of Bactria, a Greek Bactria kingdom. And yes, England, not this one. So you see that this is the diagram that I just show for you. And here, I think next week I will discuss about polyblank skin, about a model about how Zhang Qian moved from Dayuan to Dayuezhi. But that's just continue to show Odani's map. Yes, this one. Okay. So here you see clearly that, right? This is Kangju, and here this is also Kangju. So the boundary between Kangju and Great Yuezhi, and then the Kangju and Kushan dynasty, is dynamic in Odani's views. And of course, it is to be again discussed with you in next week, together with more philological and archaeological data. But anyway, actually, Yoshida only used this very famous map in Japan in his days when he is trying to compile many things about Sogdian. And in that book, he already discussed about Kurutobe inscription. You remember about the term Sogdic from the Hanshu and the identification of Sui as Sogdic, and also try to find the historization of it with Kurutobe inscription, but he did not make any conclusion. I think maybe we have to find the photographer, because I think right now this recording is just disrupted. So there's
what happens, the PowerPoint is interrupted, or?
I mean, the recording of PowerPoint is disrupted, maybe.
The recording?
Yes, because we just jump out the running of slide, then I think it will be disrupted.
Okay.
So far, it is not really determined about how long it was for the in Han period, and the length may be variable. I will try to explain this problem maybe in next Friday when treating the state of Kesh in the Tongdian, because Li generally meaning it is a unit of length, we know, and the basic measurement is the calculating from first the length of the owner,
yes.
And so the sixth fold of the owner, or very closer to English feet, become a Chinese pace, and a certain amount of Chinese pace become a li. But this kind of measure system is varying from Han period to Tang period. But in brief, it is widely accepted among modern scholars that the one li should be counted approximately as 400 meters. Oh, sorry, 400 meters. Okay, we continue. So I just continue to explain your question a little bit more. Actually, it is possible to measure the actual length of one li again by measuring the length of ancient city wall of ancient capital like Chang'an or Luoyang. And indeed, archaeologists produce some new data. But I will leave this to the next sessions. And let's just accept that one li just is about 0.4 kilometers or 400 meters. So I just continue to read the next phrase, actually only two characters, 行国. Actually, it's just a nominal phrase, a term. And it is translated so variably by a different translator. For example, if you read Yu Taishan's edition and commentary, it is translated as, it is a land of nomads.
Yes.
But in Xiaotoli's paper on his identification of Sogdiana with Su Te in Chinese, he translates this entry and give it as Kangju blah blah is an itinerant country. I'm not sure what it means for in English, but he tried his best. Yes. And Chuhye's paper in the proceeding of the Kushan conference around 1960s, he just translated as it is nomadic state. So here state correspond to the second character Guo, and this nomadic just corresponding to this first character Xing, literally moving or walking or so. And then in what sense, I think this is wrong, what sense, actually 1993, on his English translation of Shi Ji, he translated it as its people likewise are nomads. And this is the translation adopted by Harry Falk in his text selection for a Kushan history. And finally, Thierry, François Thierry gives Sept en Royaume Nomad.
See, there are two options.
Yes.
And I'm not sure the Chinese characters allow to decide between them. It can mean it's a country of nomad.
Yes.
But it can mean also it is a country where the court is nomad, with a moving
yes.
And I am not at all sure that issue can be decided from the Chinese characters.
Yes, I agree. And indeed, if we just placed aside about the moving or interchange of the capital in winter and summer or even more, I gave a note during that Kushan conference in Berlin in 2013 and digest to a very simple one by Harry Falk himself in this book. So here I just read what is finally published in his book. So here to translate 行国也, or I think here we are talking about another version in Hanshu and letters, as a nation of nomads, and actually this is a possibility mentioned during Kushan conference in 2013. So to translate it as a nation of nomad is satisfying because in that time we have several candidates and we debate much on it. However, whereas the translation of the first passage of Hanshu as the land of nomad is not so appropriated in my own opinion, because literally, 行国 means moving country or moving union of tribes, and so I would rather translate the passage in the respective text as the Great Yuezhi was originally a moving people or a moving country, just literally, and it changed its location, follow its heart, and the way of life is the same as that of the Xiongnu, etc. However, if we look back to the Zhang Qian's report very seriously, actually only four countries were described as Xingguo by Zhang Qian, namely these four ones with blue highlight, the Wusun in the north of Tianshan Mountains, and the Dayuezhi just arrived Bactria, and also the very remote Yancai or perhaps Aorzi, and the Kangju in our question. So what I would like to say is that I just rely on a famous commentary of Shi Ji called Shi Ji Ji Jie, compiled in the middle of the 5th century. And in this commentary, it is explained that Xing Guo just means Bu Tu Zhuo. That means it is not stitched to, or rooted into the soil. That's what it means. So it is something against, contrary to the state that is rooted into the soil or stitched onto the soil. That is the difference. On the other hand, the Guo itself can refer to either a country, to a region, to a state, as a union of tribes, of course, if it means nomadic states. For example, we know that the Wusun Guo, the Wusun is described in the Hanshu as the state of the Wusun, and in the Weishu, the Yeda Guo can be restored as the state of Astolite, something like that. So Guo is not necessarily to translate it just as a land of nomad, but rather state or even state of union or tribe. We don't know. It is to be further interpreted and discussed. Okay.
In the case of the Yuanqi, for example, it's clear it is a nomadic ruling elite,
mm-hmm.
which has settled into a country where some people are still sedentary. Archaeologically, this is a picture. We know now that in the regions where Zhang Qian met the Yuanqi, he describes them, villagers or fortified state settlements never ceased to exist. Clearly, perhaps sometimes it can be translated as a fully nomadic country, although we know now that full nomads don't exist.
Okay.
All nomads have a certain form of agriculture, and have a certain. All nomadic states rely on villagers, etc. Okay, it can be considered as such. And as far as the Heftalites is concerned, it's clearly that the members of the Heftalite elite met by the Chinese clearly have kept their nomadic way of life because they are described under ten. They are described with their yurts, and they move from pasture to pasture, and the king has several wives, each in a particular place, and he moves from one to the other. This is the elite. At the same time, we know perfectly well that the Heftalite state, towns, villages, sedentary agriculture never stopped to exist. It's enough to look at the at the Rome archive to see the continuity of a certain way of life. So I agree with you that it's impossible to impose a unified translation. It depends upon the appreciation of the context. And we have to keep a broad uncompromising covering name.
Nobody, yes, I generally agree.
State is a good choice because it can cover the spectrum from really a completely nomadic people and country to a nomadic ruling elite.
Yes. Well, what I can say only from Chinese sources is that, first of all, it is a little bit strange that Shongnu is not described by Zhang Qian as Xingguo, as moving country. In this way, perhaps there is another possibility to translate Xingguo as a country or a state during its long distance movement. It's just only a possibility. However,
isn't there another explanation? Zhang Qian did not have to qualify the Xiongnu because they were very well known to the Chinese. So there was no reason to give a particular to deal with the way of life of the Xiongnu, because the Chinese have known them for centuries. And what Zhang Qian, his aim is to provide information on countries which are lesser known or not known at all.
Yes, I think it is a possible explanation. I think it also depends on whether the order of Xiongnu ever change between different places or not. But for that, I dare not say because I'm not specialist of the Xiongnu, right? And also inside the great empire of Xiongnu, they also divide this empire to different parts, and a western part and eastern part were split by different smaller kings. The wise king of left and wise king of the right, etc. So if we really want to compare the structure of this nomadic empire with others, it will become a very difficult and complicated problem. And anyway, it is also a little strange that in the Shiji there are four Xingguo just on this diagram, but in the Hanshu, I think there are only two attestations of Xingguo. So again, Da Yue Zhi is clearly described as a Xingguo. And the other attestation is on the entry of Zihe, I think. It is described that the state of Zihe around Kochan, but in a more mountainous area, their way of life is close to the Xingguo of the Qiang and Di peoples. And these two Bavarian peoples would mean some peoples even to the Qinghai, today's Qinghai in Tibet, or the south of the Hexi corridors. So it either the concept of Xingguo is different from Bangu, the author of Hanshu and Zhang Qian's, or somehow they share the same common sense, but in the period when Hanshu is written, the other three states could be no more conceived as Xingguo. Perhaps it's just a possible explanation. And indeed, as I just refer to, actually this is an entry on the Great Yue Zhi, not on Kangji. On Kangji, right? So in Hanshu, he links these moving people in Kangji back to the ways of life as that of Xiongnu. That means, at least in the view of the author of the Hanshu, or the Ban family, we already explained, that in this case, we can imply that Xiongnu is also a Xingguo, just like what you said. But I think there's still space of different interpretation on this passage.
Je ferai probablement une. Oui, j'en reparlerai dans une séance suivante. Donc, on voit très bien que la notion de Sogdien se précise à cette époque, hein, avec les articles de Pelliot, qui n'a pas tellement écrit. Oui, Chavannes. Bien entendu, Chavannes parle en grand détail des pays sogdiens, des principautés sogdiennes, mais on voit très bien en le lisant que il a une perception pas très claire du type de civilisation que ça représente. En fait, parce que à certains moments, il semble les considérer en fait comme il parle d'intermédiaires nomades. Voilà, il n'arrive pas véritablement à mettre de la substance derrière les. Il reproduit les descriptions, mais il est mal à l'aise pour. Désigner l'état de civilisation. Pelliot est le premier qui comprend le problème, qui comprend la question, qui comprend qu'il y a eu des colonies sogdiennes. Voilà. Son article sur la colonie sogdienne du lobe nord paru en Étienne, 1930 et quelques, même très tôt. Hein ?
1923 ?
Ouais, c'est ça, c'est ça. C'est vraiment le premier qui ait compris ça. Et puis, avant même qu'on ait eu par Reichelt la première traduction des anciennes lettres qui montrent l'activité d'une colonie sogdienne en Chine. Et puis, donc, sur la définition... la définition de la sogdienne proprement dite, positionnée par rapport au Kankyu, c'est évidemment Shiratori qui a ouvert la voie. Alors, ce que je voudrais dire, c'est que tout ça, aussi bien Chavannes, Pelliot et Shiratori, ne savent à peu près rien de ce qui se, trouve dans les couches archéologiques la sogdiane à cette époque, voilà, correspondant à cette époque, puisque il y a très peu de fouilles qui ne donnent pas des résultats, qui ne sont pas menées de manière vraiment scientifique. Et bon, il y a du matériel, on voit qu'il y a du matériel sogdien dans les, dans les musées, on commence à connaître les terres cuites, etc. Mais ça ne, ça ne donne qu'une perception extrêmement partielle. Mais les choses ont bougé brusquement côté soviétique, exactement, disons, dans les années, fin des années 30, enfin, dans les années encadrant la Deuxième Guerre mondiale. Juste avant, il y a la première révélation de la vie aristocratique et palatiale sogdienne par les découvertes de Vararsha. Ça a commencé avant, c'est donc dans l'oasis de Boukhara, ça a précédé tout ce qu'on a trouvé à Samarcande et à Penjikent. Hein. C'est donc Chichkine qui a commencé à publier des articles sur la découverte du palais de Vararsha, qui est donc le palais hors les murs des souverains de Boukhara, avec la première révélation de l'art de la peinture murale. Alors évidemment, la grande publication complète, bien illustrée avec les moyens de l'époque, ne va paraître, je crois, qu'en 1962. Mais voilà, on commence à ce moment-là, c'est la première révélation. L'un au moins des panneaux de Vararsha sera à l'exposition au Louvre en novembre, avec une reconstitution du Salon Rouge où elle se trouve. Et puis, après, là, on a quelque chose de moins spectaculaire, mais d'extrêmement solide, juste après la guerre. C'est un article, un gros article, absolument fondateur, de Terenochkine, qui a en fait repris pour la première fois sur des bases scientifiques les fouilles de Samarcande. Alors, les fouilles de Samarcande, elles avaient commencé depuis... depuis pratiquement la conquête russe, enfin les premières fouilles vers 1880, mais ce sont vraiment des dégagements post-stratigraphiques. Y a du matériel qui sortait, qui s'entassait dans le musée de Samarcande. On ne savait pas bien dater. On a surtout trouvé la mosquée, puis des choses d'époque islamique. C'était l'archéologue Viatkin, il avait laissé partout des tranchées, voilà, parce qu'il fouillait le long des murs, il longeait les murs, évidemment à l'époque il n'y avait aucune notion de stratigraphie. Et en 1947, un archéologue génial qui s'appelait Terenochkine, qui avait été formé à la méthode de fouilles scientifiques sur les fouilles de mer Noire. Les premières fouilles soviétiques vraiment scientifiques, c'était en mer Noire, au bord de la mer Noire, et c'était l'héritage déjà d'une belle école d'archéologie à l'époque des tsars. Et Terenochkine, arrivé à Samarcande, a nettoyé les bords des trous et des tranchées qu'avait faites Viatkin. Et il a établi une séquence stratigraphique. Bon, avec des couches mécaniques, enfin, c'est pas vraiment la stratigraphie comme on la comprend nous maintenant, mais c'était déjà bien pour l'époque. Et il a ordonné la céramique dans des phases chronologiques. Et je dois dire que nous, les archéologues de Samarcande, nous vivons encore là-dessus. Il a compris, Terenochkine avait compris que Samarcande apparaissait à l'époque achéménide. Il a divisé, c'est à lui qu'on doit les dénominations que nous employons toujours, Afrasiab 1, Afrasiab 2, Afrasiab 3. Je crois qu'il a divisé en 6 périodes entre la fondation et la conquête islamique. Et actuellement, dans la publication des céramiques que nous préparons, par rapport à Terenochkine, je dirais, nous avons amélioré, mais vraiment à la marge. Alors, je crois qu'on a introduit une ou deux divisions de plus, et puis, enfin, on a changé quelques dates, on a introduit quelques subdivisions de plus, mais c'est vraiment de la nuance. Et deuxième contribution extrêmement importante de Terenochkine, que je voudrais mettre en rapport avec... Le travail de Shiratori. Chao Zhong, can you show again Shiratori's drawing of the limits of Kanq?
Okay. So this that is the one. This one.
Or no, no. The line he drew in blue.
Yes. Where is it here? So actually, this is what I tried.
This is what you drew.
Yes,
extrapolating from Terenochkine's, yes. Shiratori's.
No, from Shiratori's various works, okay. Because here you find one passage and other you find one passage. Actually, in one passage of, not only, but several times in a paper, he said that, well, Kanji is just recited on today's Kyrgyz step. So it cost me a lot of time to find what is Kyrgyz step in the 19th century to early 20th century on a map, and actually I can show you later.
L'article de Terenochkine,
yes.
Je ne suis pas sûr, je l'ai paru en 1947 dans une revue assez locale, je ne suis pas sûr d'avoir la photocopie chez moi, mais ça peut se trouver. C'est un gros article de 100 pages, ça s'appelle Sog des Tchatches. Et ce qui est remarquable, c'est que, donc, il est le premier à publier une séquence, non seulement de la céramique, mais de tout ce qu'on a trouvé en culture matérielle sur le site de Samarcande. Donc, c'est la première fois qu'on voit se dessiner archéologiquement la civilisation sogdienne en Sogdiane, et par ailleurs il fait une comparaison systématique avec les fouilles de la région de Tashkent. Alors je ne sais pas, c'est un pur archéologue, donc je ne sais pas s'il s'intéresse beaucoup à la question du Kanq. Il avait certainement pas accès aux travaux de Shiratori, sans doute pas non plus à ceux de Pellio, mais là, je cite de mémoire, hein. Il montre dans son article que la culture du Tchatch, c'est-à-dire Tashkent, hein, est à la fois apparentée, proche de celle de la Sogdiane, mais qu'elle a des caractères également différents. Et donc, en fait, ce qu'il a compris, c'est qu'il y a la Sogdiane, et puis il y a les limites, disons, les limites sud du Kankyu. Voilà. Et ça, c'est en 1947. Et c'est le moment où Shiratori avait lui aussi compris que il existe en fait, deux entités politiques qui sont en rapport, mais avec une certaine forme parfois de contrôle du Kankyu sur la Sogdiane, mais qu'en fait c'est différent et les Chinois le savaient. Donc voilà pour l'historiographie. C'est vraiment, c'est à ce moment-là qu'on a posé chez nous, en Occident, au Japon et en Russie, en URSS, les bases sur lesquelles nous vivons encore. Et alors, grâce à ces bases, tout ça évidemment a complètement s'est épanoui. Quand à partir des années 50 et 60, on a eu les premières publications de la fouille de Penji Kent, ici, qui, pour la civilisation donc d'époque pré-islamique, fournissait des données évidemment beaucoup plus riches et beaucoup plus précises que Samarcande, puisque Penji Kent, après la conquête islamique, n'a duré que quelques décennies, alors qu'à Samarcande, on a 6 siècles accumulés sur les couches sogdiennes. Donc voilà ce que je voulais dire pour la très grande importance de ces années-là, qui ont, fourni les bases intellectuelles de la compréhension du matériel archéologique et artistique qui allait ensuite devenir disponible.
Okay. Just a final note that if we use this map by Frankes, then the Kyrgyzstan steppe in Shiratori's concept could be even far north to the Turkestan, as a region, and also somehow intrude a little bit southward, but actually quite a wide area in Shiratori's concept. So the main center could be just to the south of Karatau Mountains, but in his eyes, the country is spread in a far more wide area. We can discuss about
which is not untrue if we consider the link with Yangtze. The good thing, I think, in Shiratori takes, has already understood that the Chinese had heard of Khwarezm in 110 BC, and it does not include Khwarezm in Kankyu, which unfortunately Tolstoy did with a strong influence over many years among Soviet scholarship.
I think it's time now.
Hein?
It's time.
It's time. Okay. Merci.